Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 6th, 2005. This session, The Art of Raising an Ethical Child, Five Common Mistakes. Presented by Hallie Florine in the Fireside Room. Disc number FLH-2005-06. Let's listen in.
And I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist that has specialized in children and adolescents, and I've been in this business for 35 years till I came to Holden, and here I am, contributions person on the long-term staff. But I really enjoy that this summer I've been able to do this workshop. This will be the fourth occasion this summer, so it's been fun to get back to teaching just a little bit. The couple years before I came to live at Holden, I was giving a workshop called Overindulged Children, Dealing with At-Risk Youth and Their Enabling Parents. And it was an all-day workshop for mental health professionals and also school professionals. And so, this is a portion of that workshop today. And it's the second half of the workshop that started yesterday. How many people were here yesterday? Oh, good, I'm glad I put in a little review. Yeah, but you know, this is kind of a grandiose title, Creating a Conscience. And certainly I'm not, you know, planning to teach how to create a conscience in the next hour. But I do have some comments about how to raise ethical children. Now yesterday, we discussed a bit about the disturbing changes in the morality that we're seeing with kids nowadays, the rise in theft and cheating and violent crime. We have the most violent children of any of the, I think about the five or six wealthiest countries in the world. Our kids are most violent. So, and we looked at some of the changes in the family that have played some part in that. The fact that our families don't have as good support systems, that many of them don't have a close community that they relate to, and the fact that parents are tremendously busy nowadays and exhausted, and on the average have a conversation with their children 8 to 13 minutes a day. So there, you know, there's less of that kind of tie between parents and children than there used to be in the past. And then there's also, of course, a rise in passive entertainment that has made made a change in the way kids view the world.
Did you say that an average 8 to 13 minutes a day that a parent and child are in the same space?
Interacting.
Yeah, interacting.
Yeah, they might be in the same space, but well, not interacting.
Yeah, okay.
And I reviewed a little bit about the brain and how the brain develops, and talked about the kinds of memory that we have, and two major kinds of memory. One is based on the amygdala, which is our emotional processing center, our emotional memory. And then another part of the memory is based, comes from our hippocampus, our more autobiographical and factual memory. And that for memories to be very well remembered, they need to have an emotional or a sensory component to it, because those memories are much stronger. And so one of the ways that parents can do effective teaching is through using critical moments. Moments when children are experiencing strong emotions, either positive or negative, or strong sensations, And if the parent can provide some learning around that, that would be very well remembered. And we talked about that quite a little bit, but I won't go into that more today. And towards the end of last session, we started talking about some issues of moral development. And there's 7 key issues that I'm addressing. Too little parenting time, the parents having a lack of a clear belief system or clear values. Third is a lack of structure and consequences that I call it fly by the seat of your pants parenting, where the parents aren't really clear about what the rules are and neither are the children. Too much help is where parents are giving their kids too much help and not allowing the child to learn how to do things or the steps for doing things. The fifth is too much stuff, where the kids are given everything they want so that they don't have any sense of value of possessions. A focus on constant happiness, that the parents' role is to keep their kids happy all the time. And lastly, too much focus on self-esteem. Now, I like to clarify this a little bit. I'm all in favor of kids having good self-esteem. But I think the mistake that a lot of parents make is thinking that self-esteem comes from a lot of gushing compliments. I think self-esteem comes from the feeling of competency. And so we'll talk about that towards the very end, okay? And yesterday we discussed the first issue, parenting time, either too little time with kids or they're misusing the time. You know, that the time they spend with their kids is all around entertainment and just having a good time. And of course, I love to have a good time with kids, but there isn't enough time spent with actual parenting. And we talked about some ways about building more time with kids, such as having a family night, or doing something major, like becoming downwardly mobile, having less stressful lives, making less money, so that you trade that for more time with the children. But one of the most powerful things that families can do is eat dinner together. Just the fact of having a regular mealtime together has seemed to be most powerful. They're the most powerful factor that they looked at in comparing it to kids' SATs. That having dinner together was the most, with their family, was the most powerful factor. Now, of course, that isn't cause and effect. It's just correlational. And the second issue we also talked about, where parents have not really, prior to having children, thought through what their belief system is, what they'd like to convey to their kids. And I went on a little spiel about how it'd be nice to have parents being licensed before they had children and going through courses where they looked at their belief system and how they'd like their kids to turn out and how they plan to go about having that happen. And talked about perhaps having a family mission statement. And when you've got kids that are a little bit older, you know, 8, 9, 10, up into teens, that can become a family project, you know, where the parents might meet together and discuss, first of all, what they'd like in a family mission statement, but then meeting with the children and having them have a part to play in the mission statement so they own it and feel like they're part of it. Okay, so let's move on to issue 3, which is a lack of structure and consequences. And I think this is really prevalent around parents nowadays. And part of it is because parents are just tired. You know, they probably both have full-time jobs. They just don't have the energy, and they give in on things just out of pure tiredness. But often, by doing that, they teach kids just the wrong thing. You know, I talked a little bit about tantrum behavior, where a kid might be having a tantrum in the supermarket, begging for candy. And this is what we call a critical moment. Whatever the parent teaches at that moment is going to be very well remembered by the kid because of the high level emotion that's occurring. So if the parent's embarrassed and says, shh, okay, just this once, what have they taught the kid? Well, the tantrums work. But you have to get to a certain level of intensity before the parent will give in. So the next time they'll get to that same level of intensity a lot quicker. So this is kind of how critical moments work. And permissive parenting, you know, back in the 70s when I was starting out as a parent, the big thing was permissive parenting, you know. And the belief was that a baby is like a little bud. And if you just let it, give it enough love, the baby will blossom into this wonderful rose. Of course, you know, anybody that's seen Lord of the Flies or read Lord of the Flies knows, you know, a more probable outcome of doing that. And so permissive parenting is kind of a way of parenting that has come and gone in terms of professionals looking at it. However, many parents still think it's the correct thing to do. And you know, one of my favorite movies for teaching adolescents something is the movie that came out last year, Mean Girls. Has anybody seen that?
No, but I read about it.
Yeah, it's and there they have a terrific example of a permissive parent. And it's really kind of funny to watch because the parent wants more to be a good buddy to the kid, her kids, than to be a parent. And one thing that I think is important for parents to realize is that you can't be always popular with your kids, that's not doing your job. There are some moments when you just have to be a parent. A lot of parents practice child-centered parenting, where the kids are just like the king and queen of the household, and everything revolves around them. And often you'll see these kinds of parents asking permission of their children to do things. Like, Mommy and Daddy would really like to go out this evening. Would it be okay if Sarah from next door came over? You know, that kind of giving kids way too much power in decision making. And then the result of that is that parents start negotiating every decision. The kids learn that they can negotiate the parent out of things. And one thing I share with parents is that kids can negotiate once they've learned good decision making. But if they haven't learned good decision making, they will negotiate just for their own pleasure rather than negotiate fair things. And so that parents need to start with limited decision making. Like, for example, with a three-year-old. Now, it's almost lunchtime. You can put your toys away now, and then after lunch, we can watch that new video. Or, if you want to keep playing, that's fine too. You can play, but then after lunch, you'll need to pick up your toys, and we won't have time to watch the video. And so the parent has given the child two options, but both are okay with the parent. That's the key. You know, the parent needs to select two things or three things that are okay with them. And then each of the decisions will teach the child something. You know, perhaps the child will say, oh, I want to keep playing. Well, then after lunch, the child is disappointed and has learned something about delay of gratification, which could be very valuable. But I think until kids are making good, thoughtful decisions, negotiation shouldn't be an option. This is the worst one, is protecting from consequences. You know, a kid that's picked up for drunk driving, and the parents think, oh, I can't let my child have this on their record book. It'll ruin their life. So I'm going to retain a high-powered attorney and get them off. Well, you know, that's teaches the child. That's another critical moment. The child's very upset, or adolescent is very upset. And if the parent teaches, I'll get you off the hook, this is an important learning that they're going to carry with them throughout their life. And I think that's true. You know, the way I look at it is if when kids are little, you know, babies and toddlers, you protect them. You know, you don't say, oh, I'm going to let my child stick their finger in a light socket just to understand the consequences. You know, you protect the child from that. But the older the child gets, the more you allow them to take the consequences of their behavior. So by the time they're well into adolescence, the parent shouldn't be protecting them, except if there's loss of life or serious bodily injury involved, that the parents really need to allow the kid to experience those consequences. Just a little anecdote. I, you know, was on the road with this for so long, and I heard all of these anecdotes from teachers and principals and counselors. And this one example was a kid, the parents found a pair of sneakers in the kid's closet that were obviously, you know, incredibly expensive shoes, and they knew they hadn't bought them for him. And this is kind of a cocky, you know, wise acting kid. And so they confronted him, and he said, yeah, he'd stolen the shoes. Well, you know, the best decision in that case, of course, is to have him return the shoes and ask the shop owner for some consequences for it. But they felt that he was such a cocky kid that they needed to teach him a stronger lesson. So he did return the shoes, and then the parents said, you need to earn the value of the shoes at home. For the next month, you need to do these tasks for these amounts of money, you know, cleaning the garage and all these things. And when you've earned the money, then we can get the shoes. Well, the kid did that, and then they went and bought the shoes, and then their second stop was at a homeless shelter where they donated the shoes. And I thought this was just a really lovely way of teaching him a number of things. I often would get comments from out of control teenagers when they just do what they want anyway. And these parents had a kid like that where they grounded him, said he couldn't use the car. So he had made duplicate keys and just took off in the car. And the parents were, you know, what do we do? And so one day when he was home, away from home, they took all the tires off the car. And he had to earn the tires back one at a time before he could drive the car again. I loved that one. I thought that was really pretty good. I would spend a lot of time in airports while I was traveling, and you can see so many examples of this behavior in airports, where the moms say, come here and sit down, honey. Don't run around like that. Now, if you don't sit down, you're going to get a slap. You know, and the mom will be calling for about the next 20 minutes and never follow through. And that, I don't know about you, but that drives me absolutely nuts. Because kids, a study showed that kids can say exactly how many times it takes before the parent lowers the boom. And they'll go right to the one before it. They're very well aware of it. Another is having discipline that's fairly meaningless. You know, parents will say, go to your room. And they've got a TV and a computer with the internet and a DVD player. And, you know, I'd like to spend time in their room. You know, it's so entertaining. So in consequences, it needs to have some emotional tone. Now, I'm not recommending beating kids, but there's got to be something that's a little bit painful about negative consequences in order for them to have the emotion to remember it. And the best thing is to have the consequences suit the behavior, and we'll go into that in just a second. I've heard so many parents say, I trust my child. You know, my child can go to a party where there's drinking and pot, but I trust him because I know he would never use. You know, I think it pays for parents. First of all, I think trust needs to be earned. It doesn't need to be automatically there. And so if a 13-year-old says, you know, why can't I stay at home alone while you're away this weekend? Don't you trust me? You know, the correct answer is no. Actually, I don't. I haven't had enough experience with you being alone to trust you. Now, we could build up to that. I could start leaving you progressively short times alone, and as you gain my trust, maybe eventually I'll feel okay about leaving you alone for the weekend. But I think a lot of parents get kind of negotiated into that by their kids pulling, don't you trust me? It's like if I had a conversation with one of you, first time we met, and I think we have a lot in common. We could really be good friends. Does that mean I would loan you my car? Probably not, because I haven't had enough experience with you. That's the kind of thinking I think parents need to do. Now, I had talked yesterday about my very favorite book about overindulgence. And it's by three researchers on overindulgence, Jean Clark with an E, Connie Dawson, and David Bredehoff, who teaches at Concordia University in St. Paul. Minnesota is the center of research on overindulgence. And I think it's all those stoic Scandinavians. But this book is called How Much is Enough? And it's really a practical, excellent book. And it happens to be in our bookstore. But just to review the definition of overindulgence. Overindulgence, it can be one or two of three things. It can be, first of all, too much stuff, not only material things, but recreation. Lack of structure or rules. And so somebody pointed out yesterday that a neglected child can also be an overindulged child. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that parents that are neglectful and let their kids get by with all sorts of things, that's overindulgence. And the third is too much help, where the parents are, for example, almost doing their homework assignments. In fact, one teacher told me that she had one child in her class that it was an English class, and this child was having real trouble with composition. And so one day, her handwriting changed on an assignment, which is a little bit suspect. And so the teacher called the father, and the father readily admitted that he had done the assignment. And the teacher was just shocked and said, well, what is your child going to do when he gets to college? And the dad says, well, he's going to go to the junior college in town. In other words, he'd probably do his assignments for the kid there, too. In fact, I'm told, and some of you teach at a college level, that more and more kids at a college level are requiring more assistance than they used to. And some colleges are saying, we won't accept applications unless they're done by the student themselves, or, you know, things like that. A funny one, I can't remember what state I was in, but I was watching the news, and some people say this is,
That's us.
Any small person out here?
Is the bones of child rearing. Nurture cushions the bones. I really like that. But you need to have a framework for the child. For some parents, I found it helpful to compare it to sports. You know, if you don't have any rules, what do you have? You don't have a sport anymore. You just have people running around. And so that in a sport, kids are taught the rules. And they're taught that if they break the rules, there's penalties for that. And so that's kind of how we can look at discipline. I think the word discipline has gotten a bad rap. And if you think of discipline coming from a Latin word that means to educate or to teach. Discipline is the process of teaching kids important things. And I And discipline should lead to good decision making. It should help kids to know how to make better choices the next time. And I think it's really valuable to present that to kids that way. I'm sorry you made that choice. As you recall, the consequences for that is whatever it is. That the behavior is viewed as a choice.
Just an observation on the sports analogy. I thought about that before, but it's actually kind of a turning on us, because in the sports analogy, you get 5 fouls before you're out. And the goal is how many you can get away with when you're out. Which I'm not sure is what we want to teach.
Yeah, I think you need to look at it in its broadest sense.
Don't
examine this analogy too closely. Yeah, you're right. I always have to put, I have a niece who loves The Wicked Witch of the West, so I always have to put that in somehow. But, you know, punishment, when you think of punishment, it's about retribution, it's about anger. Parents would ask me, how do you feel about spanking? And I would say there's times when spanking is okay, as long as the parent isn't angry when the parent is doing it. Well, most people think about it and think, I wouldn't want to spank a child when I'm not angry. You know, it really takes anger to get the steam up to spank. While discipline, you don't have, you know, when you get a parking ticket, the meter person doesn't stand and yell at you and say what an awful person you are, just simply writes out a ticket. You know, it's done in kind of a neutral fashion, and it's spelled out. So consequence should be given without anger and be handled as a choice. And framed to the child as a choice. And it should be proportional. A lot of times when parents get angry, they'll say, okay, you're grounded for the next 3 months. You know, that it's not proportional. And be specific, not that a kid is bad or a kid is always this way, but this is the specific behavior that it requires the consequences. And whenever possible, it should represent cause and effect. You know, so for example, a kid comes home from school, makes himself a peanut butter and jelly, piece of toast with peanut butter and jelly, and leaves the peanut butter jar open and the sticky knife on the counter and crumbs everywhere. A parent could say, okay, go to your room for the next half hour. Well, that would teach something, but it would be more effective if the parent said, I think you need experience in how it feels to clean up other people's messes. So for the next 2 days, every time a person makes a mess in the kitchen, I'd like you to come clean it up. That way it's kind of representing cause and effect. And of course, be educational. Another comment is when parents come to a therapist, usually that they're at the about their kids. They're usually at the end of their rope, and all they want to know is how to punish their kids. You know what they should do. And what I always tell them is that you need to start with not only rules, but also relationship. That you need to work on developing a better relationship with your kid. Because if all you're doing is focusing on the rules, that's all you're going to get, is an angry, resentful child that may be intimidated into not doing a certain behavior. But the child is not going to get better. The child needs to feel good a larger amount of the time than feeling awful. That makes sense to folks? Just a couple more things. You know, if parents have a really strong relationship with their child, you know, strong positive relationship, often no external reward is necessary. I just hate it when I hear about parents paying for grades. You know, children should be satisfied enough, first of all, with their parents' pleasure, and second of all, with their own pleasure in doing well, that the parents shouldn't have to do that. And so that good relationship and a smile or a compliment should be enough. And then, of course, the parent, this is one thing. I did so many things wrong as a parent, but this is one thing I did right, and it's what I call noticing. Where I, instead of just thinking something, I'd say it out loud. Like if I'm having a really nice conversation with my son, I would say something like, "You're really good company today." And it wasn't a gushy compliment, but it was just noticing something and commenting on it. And also having the child evaluate before you do. You finished all your homework before supper. How does that feel? Child might say, "That feels good." And you say, "Yeah, I'm really proud of you because now you have the rest of the evening free." You know, that self-evaluation is so important because then it'll eventually lead to intrinsic reward. I think most all of us here love to learn. Would you agree? No. And somehow our parents taught us that learning is fun, that learning is rewarding, or else we learned it down the road. Too much help. I won't spend too much time on this, but I've had parents argue with me because they say, if my child is going to get into a good college, I need to help them because all the other parents help their kids. And that, you know, it sounds like it's an okay idea that the child gets a better grade so they can go into college if they want. But what's happening is the child isn't learning the work skills. I have a son that's 31, and I was telling him about this workshop when I was doing it, and he said, "Remember what you did when I was in fourth grade?" And I said, "No, I don't remember." And he said, "Well, I had to do a state report, and I came home, and I was crying because I couldn't figure out, there were so many parts to it, I thought there's no way I'm going to get it done." And so I said, "Why don't we get down the calendar and plan this?" And I have no recollection of this, and maybe my son just dreamed it or something. But anyway, apparently I said, "Break it down into things that you can do in an hour. And then we're going to put it on each day until the report is due." And he said, "You know what, Mom? I still do it." And he showed me his calendar where he was planning something. But that's kind of, I think, the role that parents are needing to play, where they give them the tools rather than assist them to do it. And what I think we find is when parents are over-functioning, children respond by under-functioning. That the more a parent does to help out, the less the child ends up doing. Just go on to here. And so the answer to how much help should I give my child is that the child needs to struggle. So it's enough help that the child still has to struggle, but not so little help that the child is overwhelmed. And the story I use is, young Samuel watched, fascinated by a butterfly's struggle to get out. With the intent of being helpful, the boy cut away the chrysalis. But to his dismay, Samuel's butterfly, released from its struggle, couldn't fly. By giving too much help, the child ends up crippled. I'm going to skip that one for now. One of the most important things for kids is to do chores. I mentioned a study yesterday that was done by a researcher at the University of Minnesota, where he was looking at all kinds of measures of success in young adulthood, whether it was getting higher education or having a good job and quality of relationships and ability to handle money and things like that. And then he tried to correlate that with all different kinds of things that happen in childhood. And the best predictor of high success in young adulthood is whether children started chores by age 3 or 4. I think I said 2 to 3, and it's actually 3 to 4 yesterday. But it's at that age that kids love to do chores. You know, they just really enjoy doing chores. And so if you get them in the mode of doing it, then by the time they're old enough to not like chores, it's part of their repertoire.
Allie, I think personally I had some problems with this because it's hard to give them chores that seem meaningful or that they find valuable. You know, I used to compare it to the example of when we lived on the farm, and the things that you had to do were important for the survival of how the family unit got through.
Yeah.
I found living in suburbia, having to undo waste baskets or make your bed in the morning or, you know, certain kinds of chores, it didn't seem to matter whether they did it or not.
Yeah.
And when I was trying to come up with the chores to get children to do this, I couldn't find the things that it seemed like our family wouldn't manage if they didn't do it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. Sometimes parents need to go out of their way to create chores. You know, I've had a lot of parents say, it's easier if I do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point isn't, you know, the help to the family, although that can be part of it. The point is the child learning that in order to be a member of the family, you have to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you start early enough.
That's what I think you're really right about the 3 or 4, because what David and I remember when we had our 2 and 3 year olds, you know, the house would be really messy and we'd kind of wait for the child to get to bed and then we'd scurry around and pick it up so it would be nice for so that we could stand it. But we didn't really pull the 3 year old in on it.
Yeah. And probably that, you know, with a 3 year old can be presented as a fun game.
Yeah, or to do part of it.
Yeah. You know, a 3 or 4 year old can help setting the table, for example, you know, putting the spoons out or something like that that can gradually lead to setting the entire table. Or, you know, just parts of tasks, because they enjoy so much working side by side with their parent that by learning little pieces, eventually they master the task and can do it themselves. Yeah, it's a tough one.
I think my children would tell you I didn't have patience with that. I wanted it to happen quicker than they would do it.
I think that's so typical.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, you know, especially with how busy we are, you know, to take the time to have a kid do it when we could just do it like that really takes a lot of patience. Yeah. And keep in mind, I'm not saying I did all these things. mm-hmm. And then sometimes parents will say, well, how can I get my older child to do chores when they refuse? And that's a good opportunity to teach reciprocity. As a parent, we do things for kids that are really not an essential part of a parent's job description. You know, we might drive them to fun events, or we may make a special outfit, or, you know, there's all kinds of little things parents do that aren't totally necessary. And so if the child learns that when they don't do a chore, the parent is going to back off of extra services. And with the statement, well, when you start doing your part, I'll start doing my part. So that the child learns that teamwork and sharing are important. You know, one of the... I'm a PowerPoint junkie. I think one of the things some kids today aren't learning is perseverance. You know, their parents are so intent on exposing them to lots of activities that by the time they grow up, they've tried everything and learned nothing. You know, oh yeah, I took piano for 2 years, and yeah, I tried out the flute, or yeah, I, you know, played this sport. But I think that there needs to be a part of parenting that focuses on perseverance. I love that picture.
Know.
You know, and what I imagine he's saying is, I don't have anything to do. I'm bored. Let me give you my little spiel on allowance. You know, I think allowance is about managing money, but I think it has to be in some way meaningful to the child. When a parent buys everything that the child wants, the allowance is not meaningful. But you know, if a teenager says, "Well, I don't want just regular jeans from Target. I want, you know, I don't even know the new jeans."
Gerbeaux, they were.
What is it?
Gerbeaux.
Once upon a time.
Once, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it makes sense for the parent to say, well, I budgeted $30 or $35 for a pair of jeans. Now, if you want to buy the $80 jeans, you're perfectly welcome to, but you'll have to use your allowance. And if you want to earn extra money, put some extra tasks on a list with how much you'll get for them, and then you earn it. So that the child learns the connection between hard work and buying more expensive things. You know, there's all these kids that have jobs, you know, as a clerk at Macy's, but feel that they should have designer clothes. They've never learned that if you have a job where you don't earn much, you're not going to be able to buy designer clothes. And we need to understand the difference between wants and needs. And, you know, in actual fact, that we have very few true needs. We have the need for food and water, and we have the need for shelter and appropriate clothing. And perhaps the means to get around, whether it's taking a bus or having a car or whatever. But research on happiness has shown that beyond having these things, nothing else that you buy makes you any more significantly happy. There's no correlation between the amount of stuff you have beyond those things that make you happy.
Mention the want and need illustration that you gave yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this teacher was telling me, she's a primary school teacher and a grades teacher, and she was teaching a little section on this. And so one little girl thought she'd gotten the concept, so she raised her hand and said, a television is a need. A remote control is a want.
All a matter of degree, I suppose.
But, you know, I think one of the reasons Holden is so valuable for kids is for them to understand they can get away from television and they can get away from phones and have a great time, that those things aren't necessary for survival.
Yeah. Last week I had a conversation with Kathy Ojukangas, the mom of the 3 year-old kids who came in, and the first day they whined all day because they didn't have their Game Boy or whatever it was. And by the time the week had ended, they were running around playing and the word didn't even come up.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one small example, but...
But it's wonderful. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's one reason so many kids have spent a lot of time here end up so creative.
Because, and adults, too.
And adults, too, yes. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten more books read here than, you know, and I'm a big reader, but, you know, you just read a lot more here. And for some people, Jean Clark has talked about four questions that parents can ask themselves. I have a quarter of.
It's a little more than that. It's about 11 minutes.
Okay.
12 minutes.
I won't go through that then. Let me just go forward a bit. I got to tell this little story. A social worker that came to a workshop had a husband who was an accountant, and she said in their home, as soon as the child could make any kind of mark on paper, they were started with an allowance in their home. And the dad started them with a very simple form of record keeping about how they spent their allowance. And then, at the end of each year, he audited their books. I love that. Only an accountant, right? And they got a raise in their allowance depending on how well they managed their money that previous year. And I really love that idea. And he said by the time, she told me that by the time the kids were 16 and 17, they got a monthly allowance that paid for their clothing, their books, you know, everything they wanted, they managed themselves because they had demonstrated their ability. And another thing I want to mention that's so important is creating savvy consumers. For example, a parent going into a store, like let's say go into Toys R Us. And you know how in Toys R Us there's all these big displays that you go in. And the parent's saying, see these displays, how bright they are, and they're right here in the front of the store? That's because the store wants us to buy these things. But we're smarter than the store. We already decided what we're shopping for, so we don't pay any attention to them. And pointing out the strategies, or in the evening, if you're watching TV as a family, having the family debate what the advertisement, what emotion the advertisement is pulling on in order to make you want to buy something, so that they get the fact that advertising is kind of a means of making you spend money. You know, we talked about children needing to experience a full range of emotions. If a parent is always protecting their child from negative feelings, the child isn't learning how to handle those feelings. The child isn't learning important facts. They're not learning how to delay gratification. They're not learning how to handle emotions in a public situation, for example. And, you know, it's very helpful for parents to teach their child little techniques of handling emotions. Like when you're really angry, to train yourself to stop and breathe and then think what is the wise thing to do in this situation. You know, so many parents feel as if the child says, you know, I'm bored. This is my favorite. If the child says, I'm bored, the parent will think it's their responsibility to keep the child entertained, when in actual fact, boredom is really the start of creativity. And if they always are solving their boredom, they're not going to have that opportunity. And also, kids need free time. And I think keeping kids so busy is really a crime nowadays. And we talked about this too much emphasis on self-esteem, but there's just a couple of things about that I want to mention. One is that some parents train themselves, and a lot of times it's unconsciously, but they just don't see their kid as making any blunders or any mistakes. And so it's always somebody else's fault. You know, my kid wouldn't have beat up that boy if he hadn't taunted him. You know, that kind of thing. And then glorification. I think that that's really, really a mistake a lot of parents make, where they glorify what the kid does out of all perspective. You know, children need a realistic understanding of their strengths and weaknesses. You know, they need to understand that it's okay to have areas that they're not good at. I'm skipping ahead because, you know, to teach a child, you know, when they play a recital, to say, what parts of the performance did I do really well? What parts did I need to improve? And I think one of the biggest mistakes is emphasizing a child as being superior. And I think that that's one of the factors in the increasing amount of disrespect and bullying that is going on in the schools. That is one of the key problems in schools, is the bullying problem. And so teaching compassion is so very important. And understanding that they're part of a community and a world, and that everybody has skills and value and problems, and that their problems are no more important than others. And just wanna, this is a book that's in the bookstore, some of you may be familiar with, Queen Bees and Wannabes. I really like this because this is about girls' bullying behavior, which is different from guys in general, but just as cruel. And that movie, Mean Girls, is a wonderful example of that. And the book, The Bully, The Bullied, and The Bystander, is another good book about bullying. And my last recommendation is for parents to think about having a parenting support group, where people that are like-minded to them get together, and maybe even have a family thing where the kids play together and the parents sit around and talk about their issues. Because often you will hear, you know, your kid's friends, their parents will be doing really destructive things. So you need to get support for doing a better job of parenting. And this quote I really like: we sow a thought and reap an act. We sow an act and reap a habit. We sow a habit and reap a character. We sow a character and reap a destiny. It's in those small acts of parenting that we really build the child's character. The small choices that we make, the things that we teach, all go into forming a child's character. And sorry we had to rush through the last ones, but thanks so much.